Going Linux episode 190, Using Virtual Machines, the Advanced episode. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
And I'm your chief executive minion, Bill.
Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that'll help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, Using Virtual Machines Advanced. Well, since our last episode on virtual machines, we've had a lot of feedback on that introductory episode. Some of them were making corrections and some thanking us for making the topic clear.
Yeah, and thanks everybody for your comments and suggestions. They were appreciated so much. And Larry and Bill, you'll remember a couple recording sessions ago, we got almost all the way done and my computer locked up.
Yeah.
And so I didn't get to say goodbye, so to all the people, goodbye. But anyway, I found out what's doing it. It happens every once in a while, and it's frustrating. Well, I run VLC as an audio player.
Right.
And I'm an old-time radio fan, so I listen to tons and tons and tons of old-time radio shows. And if I'm in the middle of something, and I'm done for today, I just pause it and come back later. No big deal, because it'll pick right back up where I left off. Well, sir, it happened again to me yesterday. The machine just entirely locked up, so I could barely get to a terminal to run top. But once I did, I noticed that VLC was using 2 gigs of virtual memory, and the drive was just thrashing like crazy. So since then, I haven't had the problem because I've stopped using VLC. And I love VLC. It's a great program, but it's got a memory leakage problem, at least on my machine.
So what are you using instead?
They just call it the audio player, but I believe it's Totem.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Huh. That's interesting that VLC has that problem. I don't use it the same way you do, so I didn't notice that. But interesting.
Just laying there in pause, doing nothing, it's gobbling up virtual memory, which means it's using the hard drive. And then every once in a while, the management system has to kick in to clean things up. And if I don't use VLC, I don't have the problem. In case anybody else was having it.
Okay, well, there's the solution. If it hurts when you do that, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Is that on your little MSI?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's weird.
Even so, it shouldn't do that on any computer.
No.
No, something's wrong with the program itself. Yeah. So, thoughts, Bill?
I was just going to say, not much to report. Just been playing a lot with virtual machines and learning the ins and outs. And, hey, Larry, did you know if you pull certain files out of a Linux operating system, it just kind of stops working? Just thought you should know that.
No, I haven't had that experience, but perhaps Tom has.
Well, not recently, but in the past, I've done some really stupid things.
What have you been doing?
Well, I got a little impatient with one of my virtual machines, so I just said, to heck with it, turn it off. It did not like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I had to restore from a snapshot, and I'm like, whoops. Okay, note to Bill, don't do that again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and this was on VMware, right?
Yeah, it was on VMware.
Okay. Well, you know, as you know, we talked a lot about VMware in the last episode and VirtualBox and several others, but one of the ones we didn't talk about was KVM. Certainly not in any depth, and we've had quite a few emails mention the fact that we omitted KVM, which stands for Kernel Level Virtual Machine. And Ken Leyba, the small box admin, wrote us a lengthy post on our forums that our listeners can go to and check out that. He's got a lot of information in there. And we also received an email from Keith Murray. And let me read that here because it's a brief explanation of what KVM is. He offered to provide us some additional detail, which he's done. And it arrived this morning in my email box, so his timing is impeccable here. But before I get into Keith's email, let me just explain that KVM is a virtual machine that is built into the Linux kernel, and it's been built into the kernel as of version 2.6.20 of the mainline kernel. And you can find information, more information about KVM on linux-kvm.org, and you may have to put the www in front of that one, I'm not sure. But that's the KVM site, and it's got a lot of information there about it. And there's also a tutorial that I found on the How to Forge website on KVM that talks about virtualization with KVM on Ubuntu 12.10. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Now, Keith's email reads this way. He says, "Hi, Larry. Hi, Keith. I hope this information is still in time to be useful. I've been buried under a project from hell at work, and I haven't had much free time in the evenings for geekery. KVM is a hypervisor. This is the underlying piece of software that governs the operation of the virtual machine guests running on a host operating system. In simple terms, the hypervisor provides the environment inside which the virtual machine runs. It provides managed low-level access to the hardware so that the VMs can do their thing. On top of KVM, you still need to have some sort of management tool. There are some available on the command line. However, the simplest option is the Virtual Machine Manager, which is available from the Software Center. This VMM works a lot like VirtualBox, but uses KVM for virtualization instead of VirtualBox's own internal engine. I'm doing some additional experimentation with KVM this week. I'll let you know how that goes and provide some insight on some more tools if I can. Keith." Well, thanks, Keith. Yeah, that's cool. Sounds very useful, and we really appreciate your contributions. The other thing that goes hand in hand with KVM is QEMU, and we mentioned QEMU as a virtual machine software on our last introductory episode, and that is a software virtualization that uses KVM as the virtual machine. So it's kind of, as one listener put it, a cousin to KVM. It works hand in hand with KVM. It uses KVM to do the virtualization. So we did kind of talk about KVM, but we didn't actually mention it itself. And from what Keith says, there's also the VMM, the Virtual Machine Manager, which you can use instead, it appears, instead of QEMU to do the virtualization.
Huh.
So that sounds very interesting. Very, very interesting. So we'll include links to as much of that as we can on the show notes, of course. And let's get right into our advanced episode here. So just as a review, a virtual machine is something that lets you run one operating system inside another. And the definitions that we need to know going into this, we covered in the introductory episode, but just as a review, the host operating system is the one you run the virtual machine on, and the guest operating system is the operating system that's running inside the virtual machine.
Right, and you can use virtual machine for developing and testing apps on other operating systems, or if you need to run Windows for compatibility, you can use it for support. How can you use it for support?
If you are the support for another operating system, like you run Linux and you support users using Windows.
Oh, good point.
Yep.
You can use it in the classroom, and that way the little monkeys can't monkey with your machine. And you can use it to run virtual servers or workstation computers in a business network.
Right.
And, Bill, you mentioned that you were able to create and run an Ubuntu guest machine in VM Player on a Windows 8 host machine. What was up with that?
Well, one of the advanced things that you can do is you can move a hardware install and virtualize it. First, the small correction. I actually moved a Windows 8 beta using VMware's what to call standalone converter and made a VM from actual hardware. Then I stored it on the USB drive that I have, and then the experimentation began. The first thing I tried to do is, so I didn't have to store the huge image, because it was like 78 gigabytes, because it stored all the programs that were on the machine. I tried to run it from my USB, which is a 2.0. At first, it looked like it was working okay. And then it just stopped moving. So I said, I'm going to bed. I'll get up in the morning and it'll be done. It didn't. So then I said, okay, well, let me copy the VM to my computer and see if that works. And so I copied it over, and I still kept the original on the drive in case I borked it. And it worked fine. There's a few little quirks, and then I remembered that I needed to install the VMware tools to get the sound and VO drivers working. And after I did that, it started working pretty well. Yeah. Okay. But so the lesson that I learned is you might be able to do it with a USB 3 drive or a FireWire drive or something that has a little more throughput than a USB 2. But you can put it on your drive, and it will actually run really smooth. You just got to remember you have to install the guest editions. I think that's what they call it for for VirtualBox, and the guest editions or VMware tools for VMware.
Okay.
But it did work well. It did take quite a bit of resources to get it to run. I had to assign it 4 gigs of RAM because this was Windows 8 beta, and I had to assign it 2 cores, and it ran pretty good. You could still it was just kind of interesting running a virtual 8 machine on top of a virtual 8 machine. And then just for giggles, I went ahead and installed VMware for Linux on top of the VM that I had running on top of Windows 8 to see if it would work, and it did.
So okay.
A machine within a machine.
And, you know, it got a little slow, so I had to, you know, stop and give it a little bit more memory, and I threw an extra core at it, and it seemed to work just fine. But it was just kind of Ubuntu running on a Windows 8 beta running on Windows 8 final. So just to see if I could do it. But virtual machines are awesome. They're moving, a lot of corporations are moving toward, you know, taking their hardware, you know, like servers and desktops, and they're just virtualizing them on one server, and really you can't tell much of the difference.
Right. So just from a setup perspective, and to help anyone in our audience who is actually attempting to set up a virtual machine. So when you were setting things up with VMware and you found that things were running slower, one of the things you did was to give it more RAM.
I did.
And that helped, right?
It did.
So does the other thing you did was to give it, you said additional cores. I think you meant additional CPUs. I was actually corrected by a listener where I had said cores and meant CPUs. And the difference, quite frankly, is that a CPU is the hardware chip itself. The cores are the, how do you describe a core?
That's the middle part of an apple.
That's it, yeah. So the difference is that the processor itself is the chip, the hardware, and early on, chips were made with a single core. So when you were talking about cores and processors, you were really talking about the same thing. But with today's processors, multi-core processors, the CPU is the hardware, and the cores would be additional components of the CPU that make it appear to the machine like there are actually multiple CPUs or multiple processors running the machine. And it allows you to process things in parallel that you couldn't do if you had a single core chip. So
okay.
Back to what I was asking you, Bill. So the two things you did to speed things up were to add CPUs, virtual CPUs in the setup of the virtual machine, and to add RAM. So those seem like some pretty critical components to have set up properly for the fastest performance of your machine, right?
Yeah, I do want to make a slight correction. I got an email that that you forwarded me about a guy saying about the i5s not being dual core and et cetera, et cetera. There's different SKUs of processors, and what you'll find is that the mobile i5s and some of the i7s, if you don't actually look, are only dual core. I guess they do it to keep the power down. So when I was saying I was looking for something with multiple cores, which then would give me multiple virtual processors, that's what I meant. Yeah, because then you got your first generation, second generation, you got where they've added four. So depending on if you have a desktop machine or you have a laptop machine, some of the i5s are four cores, but a lot of them for the mobile market are just dual core.
Yeah, and I have an i5 in my machine, and it has two cores.
Yeah, so you have four processors, virtual processors, right?
Yeah, dual-core processor has two cores. A quad-core processor has four cores.
But don't you, hyper-threading should...
Yeah, I'm reading from Wikipedia now. Let's see here. Instructions or ordinary CPU? Manufacturers typically integrate the cores into a single integrated circuit die known as a chip multiprocessor or a CMP, or onto multiple dies. A multi-core processor is a single computing component with two or more independent actual CPUs called cores, which is different from what he was saying. Yeah, so you are right, sir.
Yes, because I actually went to Intel. I like processors, so yeah. I went to Intel's and read all their white papers.
Yeah.
And basically, there's multiple SKUs, and part of it I was right, and part of it I was wrong. I thought that all i5 processors, I mean, I was only looking at the laptop market, only had two cores. But in actuality, some of the desktop ones have four cores. And if you hyper-thread those, that gives you, it basically says there's eight virtual processors there.
So the cores are actually CPUs, and what you're saying is multi-threading takes those and creates virtual processors on top of it.
Yes, basically.
Okay. All right. Hopefully we're clear.
Basically we can boil this down to this. Without going too geeky, we could just say the more memory you have, the better when you're doing virtual machines, and the more, and if you have a multi-core chip, that also helps. And
right.
Just leave it at that.
Yeah, and I think what that means for practical purposes is the newer your hardware, the better your virtual machine is going to run, because typically newer hardware has more RAM and it has faster and more processors.
And the Intel's just making leaps and bounds in technology. I mean, the dual core machine that Tom has, my old one, is just, I mean, it's a great machine, but it just, it's nothing like these new Ivy Bridge. I mean, they have really spent the money on these things. I just can't get over how powerful they are. Processors just fascinate me, especially how they can just build them and have them work, just, you know, to keep cramming stuff onto them. I mean, yeah. I just saw one. AMD has a 12-core processor. So when you look at it, it'll have, with hyper-threading, with 24 processors. You know, if you, I'd say basically, if you have a multi-core machine and a lot and a good amount of RAM, then you should have a good experience with virtual machines.
Okay, good.
When I was using the USB external drive, it just didn't have the bandwidth for to actually run the machine. I found out that a lot of people that have desktops and even some laptops like mine have a spare bay that's empty, that they'll put like an SSD.
Sure, yeah.
And so they're pulling from an SSD the VM. They're just storing the VM. So if you, I think they're dropping price. You can get like a 300 gigabyte one, 320 for fairly cheap now. You can store three or four of those VMs and just really make those the performance just pop. And I always thought maybe the drive speed would have a direct effect on your performance. What do you think?
Yeah, I would think so as well. I haven't used virtual machines using an SSD, a solid-state drive, but I can imagine that just the access time reading from that kind of a drive would be much faster and would speed things up. I don't know how that compares with, you know, what percentage that would increase things compared with adding more RAM or adding more CPUs, but I'm sure that every little bit helps.
And another thing that I noticed, Larry, and my Windows 8 machine was running the virtual, the VMware virtual machine software, and I was trying to run it from my USB drive, but I remember a little experiment that I tried. About 2 months ago, I was running just a Linux on the hardware, and I was installing another Linux into a virtual machine running VMware, but it was the Linux version of it, and it worked. I mean, it was a little slow, but it seems like once it got loaded into memory and loaded, it ran fairly good, and I was surprised. That's why originally I thought maybe I could just go ahead and run it from my USB drive because it worked with Linux, but apparently it doesn't work that well with Windows 8 or Windows 7 or whatever. Not saying, but there might be some things I don't know about, but take that for what your mileage may vary, but I did notice it worked.
Okay. So, Bill, I have some questions from a listener. That listener is Kerbuntu, who emailed us and thanked us for the introduction to virtual machines, and he says that he's been using VirtualBox for several years because, as he says in his email, for the purpose of running an instance of Windows XP, there is a special academic software I use that has no close equivalent in Linux, and HAL would probably have to freeze over before the publisher would consider publishing it for our OS. Heard that before. He says the VM setup works well on this 4.5-year-old laptop, especially now that I've bumped my laptop to 8 gigabytes of RAM. But there are a couple of things I'd like to do with this particular virtual machine. So he writes out his things that he would like to do. So let me just read them and we can address them as we go. He says, frankly, I underestimated the size of the virtual hard drive when I first created this about 3 years ago. I made it one that could grow to as much as 30 gigabytes. Now I wish I had it capable of growing to 60 or 75 gigabytes. Do you have any experience increasing the size of a virtual drive like this? Bill, how does VMware handle that? Or does it do it at all?
VMware has what they call fixed and dynamically expanding.
Right.
And I always pick dynamically expanding because once you get things installed, it just keeps growing and growing and seems to just give it a little bit more each time you need it. So.
Right. And VirtualBox does the same thing. When you first set up a virtual machine, it asks you a similar sort of thing. Now, I think you have to make that selection at the beginning. And once you've made that selection, you can't switch. So you can't start with a fixed size and then switch over to a virtually expandable one or an automatically expandable one, at least in VirtualBox. Is that sort of similar for VMware?
Yeah, I've never found a way to take a fixed and make it expanding or vice versa. So, yeah, I think you have to pick it when you're creating it.
Now, I'm pretty sure the listener said that he did make it expandable, but that it had an upper limit.
Right, which is the way I think that VirtualBox works, is you can make it expandable to that limit. And what that really means is if you start off with, let's say, a minimal installation that takes up 5 gigabytes, you can say, allow this to grow to 30, but the actual size of the file that it creates on your hard drive will be whatever the storage amount necessary to make it work is. So if you've got 5 gigabytes worth of operating system and applications and data, it only takes 5 gigabytes on your hard drive, but it'll go up to whatever you say the maximum is. So that's the.
So we don't know how to push that maximum out.
Yeah. So one way that I can think of to make this work would be to use some software within the virtual machine that would take a snapshot, a backup, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And start over.
And, yeah, create a new virtual machine and restore that backup to the new virtual machine. And if it's an infinitely expandable one, fine. If you just need to go from 30 to 60 gigabytes, make the new one 60. And that'll work. And the software that I use for that is CloneZilla. And I haven't used it to do this in a virtual machine. There's no reason why it shouldn't work. I've used it on actual hardware where I've gone from a small hard drive to a larger hard drive, made a backup of, essentially an image of the drive on a small hard drive and put in a blank large hard drive, restored it from the image, and now I've got exactly the same computer with exactly the same setup, but a much harder, larger hard drive.
On that same vein, when you're creating your virtual machine, it will ask you, well, it does on VMware, do you want this in a single file or multiple files? And it'll say if you put it on multiple files, it's easier to move.
Okay.
And so I don't know how VirtualBox does it, but I always pick the multiple files. It puts it in its own little file, and you just drag the file to your USB drive or your storage medium. But I find that that works really well. So just something to keep in mind.
Yeah, if VirtualBox has that kind of an option, I haven't seen it. It may, but I just haven't seen it. So continuing with Kubuntu's questions, he says, the next point is really a Windows XP question, but it's forced on me due to my VM setup. For the virtual machine, I use the XP license that was plastered on the bottom of the laptop on which it was originally created. The laptop hard drive was wiped in favor of Ubuntu several years ago, so I felt free to use the license, especially since it was on the same machine. But now that particular 8-year-old laptop has come to the end of its life. It seems incapable of installing any version of Ubuntu later than 10.04.3, long-term support. For the sake of support consistency, I wanted to upgrade all the computers in the household to 12.04.1 long-term support. That probably means I will reinstall XP on said laptop and give the machine away, and that means legally I can't use the co-opted license in my VM anymore. I have other unused license numbers I could employ for the purpose. Is there some way to assign a different XP license to the existing XP virtual machine instance? Or do I have to start from scratch? That would be a major headache. Not the part about reinstalling XP, which is a mere nuisance, but reinstalling the academic software and re-verifying all of the separate licenses associated with it. So,
yikes.
Yeah.
Go ahead. There's a simple solution to that.
What's that?
He said he had some unused licenses, so install XP and use one of the unused licenses and keep on going.
Yeah,
but if this other software is hooked into the Windows license, it might know that it's been transplanted and stop running.
I don't know if that's true or not, because I can still run the virtual machine of the Windows 8, it doesn't ask for. As far as it knows, it's still running on the same hardware. It never asked it still gets its updates. It still says it's fully activated. So, I'm assuming that it should work for.
Yeah, I was thinking that Kubuntu's issue is that he has this image of XP where he's taken the time to install this special software, the academic software he's talking about, with separate licenses and so on, separate from the Windows license. But that if he were to reinstall XP using a new license, now he would have to go back and set up this academic software, and he said he would have to verify all the separate licenses associated with it. So it sounds like it's fairly complex, and it's essentially from the academic software's perspective. He's installing it on a new machine because it has a different Windows license. And so he's got to go through all the pain of saying, okay, well, this software, I want to transfer it. So really what he wants to do is to take his existing virtual machine with XP and change the license key. so that it matches one of the other ones that he has. And I don't know the answer to how you would do that. That is really a Windows XP question. I don't know whether it's possible. I'm sure that it would involve making some changes in the registry, because that's where a lot of this stuff is. But I think there may be more to it than that. So that's really a Windows question, or something better asked on a Windows forum, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. You're probably going to spend a lot of time on the phone to somebody in India.
Yeah. Well, I still don't understand why he has to change. I mean, I don't understand why he needs to change this serial number. As far as the virtual machine is concerned, it's still the same. It can be on a different computer. It's isolated from the machine. It doesn't care.
Right. No, I think we understand that, Bill. I think the issue is he's taking the Windows license that he used, reinstalling it on the hardware that is the old laptop, and giving that one away. And so now he's used the license once. Okay, and he has the license also on his virtual machine. So now if he were to fire up that virtual machine while the other real hardware machine using the same Windows license is active, now we've got a conflict from a Microsoft perspective.
He actually has a conflict already, because if you look at the XP license, it says you're not allowed to virtualize it.
It depends on which XP license now, he has.
If he got the home builder one, I think it does allow you to do that. But he said he got the one installed on his machine, and right on there it says that this license is tied to this hardware.
Right, and so, he's using it on the hardware.
He's
stretching the point. I know.
Yeah, he's stretching the point. But what I'm trying to say is, he says he has unused XP licenses. Just go ahead and reinstall and use one of those licenses, and just keep your old license. It would just be so much simpler. You could still give it away. I mean, it's a valid license, and he doesn't have to reinstall. He can just move his virtual machine over.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So use the virtual machine, the license that's on the virtual machine, leave it on the virtual machine and use that on his new computer, and use one of his spare XP licenses to install XP on that the laptop that he's giving away.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then he's got to go to the computer manufacturer's website and download all the drivers and all the crapware and all the other stuff so that it looks like it's from the factory, right? Well, maybe not the crapware.
Bloatware.
If it's a four-year-old computer,
it's 8 years old.
Eight. Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he might have a little trouble finding some drivers. Depending on if it's a Dell or something like that, you might be able to find the drivers. But yeah, XP is not known for finding drivers. You have to work pretty hard. It isn't like the Windows 7, Windows 8. They kind of have a lot of it built in, but
and especially as Windows XP is coming up to end of life in a year or two, those things are going to become more and more difficult to find, XP drivers. Yeah.
You know, the whole problem seems to stem from him giving away or selling the old laptop. Why not just put Ubuntu on it and then give it away?
Yeah, that's a possibility as well. It may be the person that he's giving it away to doesn't want Linux.
Beggars can't be choosers.
Well.
Yeah. Well, that's it from the user listener questions department. Is there more that we can talk about from a virtual machine perspective? I know our intent here has been to talk about VMware in particular, because you're the expert in VMware, Bill. Is there anything more that we can dive into VMware without getting beyond our technical expertise?
I would just say the following. If you're interested in playing with virtual machines, the two good ones are VirtualBox and VMware. I don't know enough about KVM. I'll have to look into it when I have time. But you know, I've been covered with work myself. They make this VMware's free, but they make a paid version that does a lot more. You can push it to the cloud, and you can do all kinds of weird stuff. And but you really don't need it if you're just run virtual machines, you want to run XP on a Ubuntu, or you want to run Windows 7 on Ubuntu, just remember that the newer your hardware, the more memory you have, and if you have a multi-core processor, you'll have a much more enjoyable experience.
Right, and just to add to that, we received an email from Scott Dowdle, who put a video tutorial together for us. Unfortunately, we can't share it because he's asked us not to. But just watching that tutorial on KVM, it looks like a very, very good alternative to VMware and VirtualBox. And it's already installed on Linux. It's part of the Linux kernel. So his point is, why would you add third-party software to run a virtual machine when you've already got everything that you need right there on your computer? So I would encourage all of us and all of our listeners to take a look at the tutorial from How to Forge on getting KVM set up and experiment with it. Experiment with the VMM, the Virtual Machine Manager, and maybe even with QAMU. I know I'm going to do that.
Yeah, it sounds like fun.
And you said about talking about things that weren't above our experience and expertise. Well, this is all above mine. I tried VMware once. Okay, that works. It's cute. But I really didn't have a need for it.
Yeah. Well, right. If you don't have a need for it, then why stress out over it?
Yeah. Exactly. And that was quite a while ago. That was when the Linux basement first started out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Where did Chad go?
I think it's actually gone.
Wow. That's too bad, because he had a lot of good stuff on there.
He really did.
I tell you what, if you guys don't mind, I'm going to continue playing with these virtual technologies, and maybe I'll just give a quick update a couple shows later when I've got a chance to play with QVM and
sure.
KVM.
QEM, right? QEMU, yeah.
QEMU. Because, there's so many good things that you can do. And what's nice is there's open source alternatives to this, and there's also some proprietary. So I think if we can maybe get people to know the different technologies out there, maybe they'll pick them up and start using them.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay, that kind of wraps up our show, kind of, sort of, maybe.
Okay, yeah.
And I have a tip for our audience and for you guys, if you're not aware of it yourself. This one actually we received from Nightwise. And he has a tip for automatically updating your computer with Aptitude and Crontab. Essentially, what this is for people who may have multiple computers that you're supporting, Linux computers, of course, we're talking about here. So if you are the kind of person who has a lot of Linux computers that you're supporting, and you find yourself going to those computers either physically or through SSH or some sort of remote and checking to see if there are any software updates and then running those software updates. And you repeat this every week or every month or whatever you do. And you say to yourself, is there a way of automating this so I don't have to do that? That's what this tutorial is about, is how to automate. In Nightwise's post, it's Ubuntu updates with a simple command. And it's a cron job that you run, and he's got it set up to run at 1 in the morning, and it runs aptitude as opposed to apt-get. It uses a flag to ensure that you don't have to physically be there to type yes at the end of anything that's prompting you. And by using the switch safe-upgrade, it skips any kernel updates and any distribution upgrades. So you can let this run automatically in the background without running the risk that it's going to go from Ubuntu 12.04 to 12.10 overnight. Exactly. So we'll have a link to Nightwise's article and post in our show notes. And he also links to his original source for this. And that original source also has an addition to that cron job that puts the output of the updates into a log file so that if something does go wrong, you'll have a log of what was going on when it happened.
Sure. Now, aptitude doesn't need sudo?
Since you're running as a cron job, no, because the cron job, you know, is running with administrative rights to begin with.
No, I've never been able to run anything in a cron job that required sudo.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well,
And someone suggested using GTK sudo. No. Yeah, and that didn't work either.
Huh.
So I don't know.
Well, I set this up to run on one of the computers as a test, one of the computers that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And since I set it up, there haven't been any updates. So I don't know whether it's working okay. or not. So,
Okay.
Actually, Tom, to create a cron job that runs as root, the secret is to use the cron tab editor as root. So normally what you would do to create a cron job is you would start the editor with the command cron tab dash E. That would open the editor. You would add your script in there and you would save it. That would create a user-level cron job. But you can create separate root-level cron jobs by launching the editor as root. And the way you would do that is you would type at the command line sudo space cron tab space dash E. And what that does is it opens the editor, a new editor with a new cron tab file that has root access and will run as root. And you add your script there and save it, and that will be managed completely separately from the user-level cron jobs. So you can have separate, independent sets of cron jobs running, one as root, one as user. And if you have other users on your machine, their cron jobs will run, the user-level cron jobs that they create will run when they are logged in. So that is basically the way you get that to work.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Any software picks, guys? I don't know. I don't have any.
I'm kind of slack today. I don't have one either.
Okay.
Well, let's just skip that then.
Let's just do that. Okay, well, in our next episode, it is Computer America number 56.
Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations. Email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. That email is goinglinux@gmail.com.
And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use our forums to leave your topic suggestion in the thread labeled Topic Suggestions at forums.goinglinux.com.
You can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. As Tom said, the email address is goinglinux@gmail.com, and our voicemail is 1-904-468-7889.
Follow our show updates at goinglinux on Twitter or follow Larry on Google+.
You can download our episodes from our website or you can play them right on the show notes page. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later. -4.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.